I'll call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect, today is Thursday, January 25th, 2024. The time is 3:32 p.m. We are currently in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, the state capitol. Before we start, please turn off all cell phones. The members present today, Vice Chair Klayman, Senator Merrick, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Bjorkman, myself, Chair Kawasaki. We also have Senator Shelley Hughes, who has a bill related to artificial intelligence already in the hopper for us to consider. Wanted to, first of all, thank Sab Danbert, who is Senate Records, taking meticulous notes, and Shelby, no, this is Shelby Carroll? No. Yes. Shelby Carroll, as the moderator with the Legislative Information Office. Today we have a presentation on artificial intelligence. We have several folks from different areas, and I'll briefly read their biographies here in a second. I also have my staff, Griffin Sakow, who will be assisting the slide presentations. The folks are joining us on Teams, and if the folks who are on Teams can just say next slide, then the next slide will be forwarded with Griffin's help. So first today, we have Addie Cook. Addie Cook is from Global AI Policy Lead at Google Cloud. She is in her role. She supports Google Teams globally to incorporate responsible AI in external product launches, technology partnerships, customer engagements. Her roles include promoting regulatory and legislative engagement and understanding of Google's AI principles and cloud's responsible AI governance process. Addie previously held similar roles at Workday and Accenture. Addie has held several public service roles in the Texas Legislature, United States Senate, AmeriCorps, Vista, and Peace Corps in El Salvador. She holds a BA from the University of Texas at Austin and an MPP from the University of Virginia. Outside of work, she serves as a court-appointed special advocate for abused and neglected children, and she resides in Northern Virginia. If you would help welcome Addie to the committee, we're looking forward to your presentation. And if you want to add anything to your biography, please do now.
No, I think that really did cover it. Thank you for reading that. Thank you for having me. And I have to say, I'm a bit disappointed. I didn't get this invitation until a few weeks ago, else I gladly would have flown to Alaska to be there with you in person. It would have been a dream. Where it's on my bucket list. So we'll have to, this will just be a rain check for an in-person visit, I hope.
That sounds great. We have lots of rain in Juneau.
Well, I have lots of rain here in DC, so we share that right now. Let me just time check. I believe I have about 30 minutes, and then we'll do Q&A. Does that sound right, or do you want to go a little? I can also trim in a bit if that's helpful. I think
that sounds right. About 30 minutes for the presentation, and then questions. And then would you just like us to ask questions during the slides or immediately following, or does it matter?
Whatever works for you. I'm happy to do both or either. And really just if something jumps out at you and you want to ask a question, feel free to jump in. I'm not bothered by it at all.
Okay. Super. Super, Ms. Cook. Well, I guess we'll just start right now. Slide number one.
Absolutely. So I can't really see, but that's okay. I'm going to just tell you to slide forward. And we'll start with, obviously I'm here in the state committee, and I realize that a lot of the affairs in front of you are related to how government might potentially benefit from using AI. But before I jump into government use, it is worth sliding forward one slide just to talk about how this is a transformational technology. And, with any customer, any use space in a company like Google, we are treating it as seriously as you would treat any serious technology that has the potential to revolutionize the way we do business. So steam power changed the way we moved people and goods. Electricity certainly added to that. I don't need to remind you all what it was like to get your first connection to AOL and the iPhone. And look, AI is a lot of the same way. I actually tell people, I remember the day I got my iPhone. But I don't remember when all of those applications became part of my life, when Maps and Uber, all of those things just became integral in my life. And that's the moment we're in right now. We've got our iPhone and we're waiting to see how it will be applied in our daily life. And that's really the moment that the government, government everywhere finds themselves in. They've got the tools. Now, what are they going to do to put it to good use? And slide forward. We've been getting ready for this moment for a long time. Just quickly slide forward one more time. If you see this isn't actually a new technology, but the technology has gotten more powerful and has the ability to do new things. Back in 2017, Google actually put out a seminal paper on the transformer, and the transformer is the T in ChatGPT. We open sourced our research to allow the entire world to benefit from our learnings, and that was really exciting. We also benefited from our own learnings. We created a BERT, which is a transformer that supported our Google search engine and has made our search engine allow each one of you and me to surface the world's information, to have the information at my fingertips. From there, we've made lots of progress. 2021 is one of my favorite open source models that we've put out. AlphaFold, out of our Google DeepMind office, is one that is looking at different proteins and looking at how to develop new medicines. Just last week, I saw an article where they have discovered thousands of new potential pharmaceutical formulas that have never been considered to address different kinds of challenges. And so it's really interesting that all of these models are really the same, in the same vein as our search model. It's all about finding information, looking for patterns in across volumes of information that we never were able to previously. But obviously there is some very serious considerations that need to be considered when you are building new technologies that are revolutionary such as these. And we recognize that back in 2017, we put out the AI principles that you see across the bottom of the screen to ensure that all of our responsible AI all of our AI is built responsibly at the foundation. My favorite part about my job at Google, I did not realize this 3 years ago when I took the job here, is that I have a seat on one of our responsible AI review committees. So I sit on a manager level committee of a 3-tier system just in the cloud product area. And I have the opportunity to review every single product for regulatory alignment, regulatory concerns, risks, alongside legal team, our engineering team, our responsible AI team. And we all examine, figure out how to mitigate risk, and figure out really if the product is fit for market. We also support the documentation that is put out with each product before we make it available to our customers. And this is all really part of our risk management process that I'll talk a little bit about later, but just gives you a bit of a preview. Next slide. I'm sure you've heard a lot about what large language models are, but I thought worth just giving us a quick reminder about what it is. And just to maybe illustrate this, the other day, my husband and I were talking about fixing up an old car. It's sort of his dream to fix up an old car. And I was telling him, what if we found every old car manual that we could get our hands on and fed it into a large language model? I could then ask this model to tell me anything I needed to know about fixing any kind of car, as long as it had ingested that particular model of car's manual. And it would even be able to understand patterns across many different models of car, all the Fords from a set number of years that included a single part. And that's really the power of this flavor of AI that we're now using. That is what large language models are. They're taking language and allowing us to use language to interact with it. So I don't need to be, I don't need to know coding anymore to be able to access this technology. As long as I can read and write, I can operate this technology to summarize information, to honestly generate code. You know, coding language models are a big thing now. And It's really interesting. And so large language models are language models. There are other types of models. There's obviously image generation and video generation models too, and those rely on a different set of data. Next slide. But here's where we come to a really interesting crossroads, especially as policymakers, and certainly something we think a lot about in Google. The consumer-facing products that we put out at Google have very different considerations in terms of risk management than the models we put out for enterprises and government. So if you're a consumer, consumers are using it to write poems, to plan trips. You know, they may need to be careful about how they put information into the bot that, you know, is confidential, as we've seen. There was a Samsung engineer who put his code into ChatGPT and it was forever ingested. So a consumer-facing model is constantly retraining on the data it's being fed, which is why Google has prioritized making an enterprise version available, which has enterprise-grade privacy and privacy and security, and why we encourage engineers and personnel from governments and private enterprise to use the more secure version of this technology. You know, when you are an enterprise or a government, you are worried about fraud, security, controlling cost, making sure that what you're using it for is generating accurate and explainable results for the level of need that you need those services. So I always like to remind folks, especially policymakers, when you're thinking about how to either create maybe procurement policy or new regulations, it's important to keep in mind that there are two different types of this solution and for two different types of audience, and they definitely need to be considered. They're a shared technology, but how you mitigate the risks and the platform which you serve them from are different. So just a little bit more about how our enterprise technology works here. This is a snapshot of some of our offerings. At the bottom, you'll see just sort of the infrastructure layer. That's just the cloud platform. We're all pretty familiar with how to use the cloud. It's what you upload your docs to. And what we've added on to that is a bunch of foundation models. We have a text model, a chat model, code generation, image generation, and an audio and music generation model. On top of that, we have a developer suite of tools. So if you, some of our customers like banks, have whole developer teams within their company, they can use these tools to create custom solutions for the bank, for instance. Same with your IT department and maybe some of your government agencies. They can use these tools to make custom solutions. Or we do offer out-of-the-box solutions. So we have a conversation agent tool and we have an enterprise search tool. The enterprise search tool is my favorite tool because we have taken the best of Google search and allowed you as an enterprise to apply it to your documents or to your repository. So you can imagine you're sitting here in the hearing room and you have to go back to your desk and maybe you have to draft a new piece of legislation on a topic that I have worked on personally in the Texas legislature, which was poultry. I had to write an egg bill. And wouldn't it have been great if I could take every piece of legislation that my member had ever written, and trained this enterprise search model to look at all the bills he's ever written on poultry and start asking, you know, this repository of bills that just my member wrote, what, you know, how to write this bill, what are the things that need to stay, what are the things that are outdated. I could also, if I was at it, maybe point it to the Texas Poultry Association to see, you know, what are they saying about the bill, and I can start asking it that. I could also test it. I'm pointing it at two things, right? My members' bills and the Texas Poultry Association's cache of documents. Maybe I'll ask it, what does it think about Taylor Swift? It would return no results because what I am doing is only pointing at two stacks of data. And that is how we prevent hallucinations for very discrete use cases. This is why it's my favorite product, because there's so much utility here, especially for policymakers like myself who have to, you know, or people who support policymakers sifting through documents. Now I can summarize things, I can grab facts way quicker and more efficiently. On top of that, we also have our Duet suite of products, which writing tools to help you write an email, to help you write a new document, job postings, job descriptions, right in the tool itself. So kind of like what you would do with a ChatGPT or a Bard, but right there in documents or sheets. The other thing about sheets that you can do is, create a new budget template, create a wedding planning template, whatever you want. It pulls patterns from across the internet and pulls it in to say, here's what a template usually looks like for wedding planning. Next slide. But again, as I said a few slides ago, we take your data very seriously on the enterprise side. We have a longstanding commitment to make sure that any data that you're using on our enterprise products is not retrained by the underlying model. So what you're seeing here is essentially a frozen model. You see on the sort of the bottom right-hand side where it says Google Tenant, we serve you a frozen version of the model. Once it goes into your tenant, you can train it to do whatever you want. You can pull information from the frozen model, but it will not send information back. That model is not retrained on your data. This is a commitment that it puts us in a little bit different position than some of our competitors who, you know, made you opt in to not sharing their data. We felt very strongly that you had to, that our commitment was default on for you in this phase. Next slide. Now we'll quickly run through just some of the government solutions that we're seeing come online and different ideas for how governments might use this technology. Next slide. I have been a legislative correspondent in the Senate, the U.S. Senate. I've also written constituent mail on behalf of the several members of the Texas legislature that I have worked for, and I know how arduous drafting those letters can be. One of the things that this new technology can do is help us facilitate responses to constituents much faster. So it can help you draft text, giving just maybe three bullet points. I can give it three bullet points. What are the three things I want to communicate to this constituent? And it'll type a full email. I can quickly edit it and get it out the door. Or I can maybe help it to identify patterns across a large volume of mail. Maybe everybody's writing something a little bit different, but it's all on the same subject. I can quickly understand patterns across large volumes of data. Yes, I understand that your CMS system can do some of this today, but what it actually can do is a little bit more powerful than that, because what it can do is actually take you further into steps, not just the creation, but the identifying of constituents who might care. And then further that, it can help you push the button to deliver that correspondence much quickly. It's just creating efficiencies throughout the system that we haven't seen before. Not necessarily doing things you couldn't already do, but making it done faster. And in this way, it's also giving us a little bit of superpowers, right? You can have an employee who's much more efficient. A really good example, MIT and Stanford did a study last year that they put out of call center agents. And they found that an entry-level call center agent using an AI-powered chatbot to help answer customer calls to the call center was able to answer triage 20% more questions than they could if they had not had that AI-powered support engine. And what that is telling us is that we're taking somebody who's entry level and already making them a little bit more experienced than they otherwise would have been. Now they can just talk to maybe an operating manual, again, using that enterprise search function to say, you know, put in this customer's problem, maybe add a couple other questions and address the query much faster. It really does create a little bit of expertise on demand, which is another superpower that we're seeing. Next slide. But a couple of reminders before I head to even more use cases. As I said, we know that generative AI can be prone to error and hallucination. So if you're using a large API, maybe a ChatGPT type API, you're calling the world's internet. You're looking like you're looking across Google search. And we know from using just Google search that sometimes the results we get are not the results we expected to get. So that's why it's important to make sure that the type of AI you are using, whether you're using a very large sort of unbound version of this model, is fit for the purpose you're using it for, or if the enterprise search tool with a very narrow set of use set of outcomes that are possible is a more appropriate for a use case. This is really common sense risk management, but something that, you know, we're encouraging all enterprises and all governments to think about when they're communicating with workers across their employees across the enterprise to consider. Data exfiltration. Again, any vendor you use in any capacity in state government, and especially with generative AI, we encourage, you know, governments and enterprises to make sure that you read the terms of your contract and you ensure that you're not retraining the data as when your employees are using the model. You know, we think that Google has set a standard that we encourage the others in the industry to follow, but certainly, you know, a committee like yours has the power to make sure that's also default. And then last one is we encourage you to think about cost controls. Using cloud using this level of computing for generative AI can be very expensive, and it's important to consider that as part of your decision making. Next slide. Okay, here are some examples of other examples across different use cases. So the Department of Labor, transportation, education, there are many, many different types of use cases. I know you all have a copy of this, so I won't go into each one, but it certainly can get your sort of wheels turning on what might be most helpful in for addressing the challenges that you see in the state that you want to address. And that's really where we encourage most of our customers to start is, you know, what's the challenge you want to address? Not what can AI do for me? It's what challenges you have, and then is AI appropriate for addressing that challenge? In some cases, it may not be. In some cases, old-fashioned rules-based AI is still going to be deliver the best results for your constituents with less risk. But in other cases, we've seen really great outcomes. One of my favorite is using pothole identification, using video analysis to anticipate, you know, what potholes need to be triaged. In California, we've also put that same camera on top of some Office of Emergency Services vehicles to help homeowners get the paperwork they need from the government to say, my house has burned down and I need insurance. I need insurance to help me rebuild my life. You can't do that without a government document saying, affirming that your house is gone, and we can deliver that confirmation a little bit faster using technology. So there are absolutely opportunities to use this new technology as long as we're making sure that we're managing the risks along the way. Next slide. I peppered it throughout here. I have lots of reminders of risk management. So I won't go through all of them, but just suffice it to say, you know, privacy, factuality, it's things we think about. I'm not surprised that I have it like five times throughout here because it is something that I know we take seriously, and I know governments also take seriously, especially in the context of state use. Next. And I'm a little bit, I think I'm coming up against time, so I'm going to try to get through this. And frankly, I've covered a lot of it. As I mentioned, we established our Google principles. Next slide. In 2017. And in 2018 is when we set up that committee that I was talking about that I have the pleasure of serving on, where I get to review how our principles are applied to every single product before we make them available to the public. And I get to think about, well, if it's not exactly in line with our principle, what can we put in terms of a mitigation to make sure we can bring it in line? Sometimes that means we won't release a product. A good example of a product we decided not to release was our facial recognition solution. After review, just like the ones I've been describing, we decided that the outcomes and potential harms from that technology were not in line with Google's values, and we made a decision to only make that technology available to media and entertainment companies. That's one example of, you know, how you can mitigate risk, just not offering it or only offering it to a certain segment of the population. Now, of course, Google offers, and currently Google Cloud offers, an image recognition system. And you might be wondering, well, can't that do face recognition? And the answer is no. One, it's not allowed by our terms, but in the product documentation that's posted publicly online today, if you went to our image recognition site, it specifically says, this is not trained on faces. Do not use it on faces. Now, an important part of the conversation is, we give this technology to the public. We tell them not to use it in certain ways. And it's up to the deployers of the technology, the folks who use this technology, to also use it in a responsible manner. It really is a shared responsibility. Next slide. Here's a snapshot of our principles. I always like to call people's attention to principle number 7, which is my favorite principle. It talks about primary purpose. It talks about, is this unique? Is this a technology you can get anywhere? Is this only available in this one context? And therefore, we should treat it much differently. The risks are higher for misuse because I can't just get it anywhere. And what's the scale? Is this going to be deployed on the entire population of the state of Alaska? Or is it only going to be used in one back office to process receipts? Those things matter when you're thinking about risk determinations and appropriate risk management systems. Next slide. Here's a snapshot of how Google risk management for AI works. The products review committee I've been talking about is that third green box in the middle. I am on the cloud review committee because that is the product that I support. And our risks are really different than YouTube or Search or Pixel. So they have their own review committees because we like to make sure that the risks that we're reviewing are one that we can make sure we're making determinations that are repeatable, transferable, and scalable. And so while we all use the same AI principles, we have different committees to make sure that we're managing the risks that we're most familiar with, serving the populations that we're serving. Our populations in cloud are very unique to us, while those in YouTube are very unique to them. And then, of course, we have an overseer, our kind of big council of senior VPs who make sure that all decision-making below crosses over and is shared. And it's not unlike an agency. You know, the Department of Labor is going to have different considerations than the Health and Human Services Department. But you can all follow a common framework to manage risks. Next slide. But responsible AI is not the only consideration. I've been talking a lot about Box 2, but certainly the data use, I know, is a very important factor for policymakers. I've talked a lot about how we, our data commitment to our customers. But also you need to assess the data to make sure it is valid for the model you're seeking to use it in. Do you have permission to use it? And so on and so forth. When we're thinking about risk management, it's really important to think about data governance alongside AI, just as you would alongside privacy and security. Next slide. Here's a snapshot of the life cycle of a model applying responsible AI. Problem definition, data collection, model training, evaluation, and monitoring. These are all becoming, I think, a lot more familiar to us as we think about AI risk management, but I always like to put it here because it's sort of a good reminder if you're trying to anchor yourself in which part of the problem you're thinking about with regards to model risk management. Next slide, we're going to almost end here. I think I only have a few more slides on risk management takeaways. I've been asked what's different about generative AI, and my team has this really awesome slide where, you know, we talk about what's similar for other types of AI or other types of technology. You know, we're always worrying about processing sensitive data. Obviously, government, you have a lot of sensitive data. You already have governance frameworks. That's not surprising. And hopefully you've implemented strong security controls. But what's different is judgment-based decisions. When are those appropriate? When it is appropriate to use this technology to assist with judgment? Sometimes it's not appropriate. That needs to be part of our governance thought process. How these new technologies might cause harm. And what are the transparency requirements, especially in government when you're interacting with citizens? What requirements do you have to tell a citizen that they are interacting with AI or the process they're using might involve AI? These are all things we might need to consider going forward. Next slide. And I think I mentioned this always, you know, it begins with an idea. You know, when you're thinking about how to get started in any government agency, it needs to be about addressing a problem. These are different ideas for how to use it. You can use it to create things, to summarize, to discover, or indeed to automate. And all of these types of use cases are ones that you can see would be broadly applicable through government agencies. Here are some other considerations. Next slide for assessing AI projects. I'll just leave these different questions with you to consider later on. Next slide. This is a great list of organizational readiness considerations. This is obviously something we use a little bit more with our enterprise customers, because you'll notice kind of at the bottom there, it has a regulatory watch. Obviously, enterprises need to understand the regulatory landscape when they're buying a new technology. But certainly, you know, the testing and reporting, incident response, these are all things that are really core to making sure you have ready before you start adopting and using AI. Next slide. And next slide. I sit in a really fun position where I get to work with our responsible AI teams, our data stewardship, legal compliance team. I get to work with our engineering and product teams, and our audit and certifications team. All of this is to say, this is exactly the cross-functional teamwork that you're going to need in government in order to have properly managed AI with all of the stakeholder thought leadership that you need. I will leave it right there and take it for questions.
That is great. Thank you. Thanks so much for this broad overview, Addie. I also wanted to recognize we have Mr. Timothy Johnson, who's the manager of state and local government affairs at Google Cloud West Region, for questions. Maybe we can start with, we've got a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really appreciated the presentation. And I think the thing that we as policymakers are really wrestling with is what sort of regulation, what sort of statutes do we need to put in place, if any, to address the concerns that people have about AI. I know just did a quick Google search and I found looks like Eric Schmidt, who served as Google CEO for a decade, said he thought artificial intelligence could cause people to be, quote, harmed or killed in possible, quote, existential risks. Elon Musk warned the same thing. Jeffrey Hinton, who's called the godfather of artificial intelligence, warned of dangers of AI. Is that a concern that you all have? And do you think there's legislation that needs to be passed to address any of these concerns?
That's a great question. So one of the key parts of artificial intelligence development that we're seeing is the lack of security benchmarks and security testing. And so we have started working with governments to undergo this kind of testing to ensure that all of the proper controls are in place to prevent any catastrophic harms that I have also heard expressed. A few of the things that, you know, we think about when we're developing these are things like safety filters. Our safety filters intentionally currently filter out CSAM, for instance, terrorist content. If you've ever tried to get the chatbot to say anything bad, we have very strong filters in place to make sure that you can't do harmful things with that. Now, that's not to say that you can't get around those filters, but I think the other concern is not necessarily with our models, but really it's a consolidated standardized approach globally that we all need to adopt to ensure that any model put on the market can be tested against a set of benchmarks. And that is exactly what we're working with governments to do, to understand how the technology works, how it could potentially cause risk. And we're working with many third parties like RAND, ARC, the Alignment Research Center, the Turing Institute, and others to make sure that we can continue to do that kind of safety testing and research to make sure that these technologies are safe and can be used in applications that benefit all of us while we mitigate the harms.
Great, thank you. Are there further questions, and I think Ms. Cook, you'll be able to stay on, and Mr. Johnson, too, will be able to stay on for a little bit. We have one more presenter. Okay, super. We will we'll go ahead and move right along. We have a second presenter with us, and that is Elena Beller. She is the field manager from Public Citizen, and I have a bio somewhere. Okay, so I have a thanks for being here, Alana. Alana is a member of the democracy team at Public Citizen, where she leads the National Activist Program that takes part in building a movement to rebuild, strengthen, and protect our democracy. Before joining Public Citizen, she led electoral organizing programs for progressive candidates, most recently on the leadership team for a presidential candidate in the Commonwealth of Virginia. She was also part of a team of regional directors who led a grassroots program in 2019 that flipped the Virginia state legislature. Alana has always had a passion for helping young people build power and make their voices heard. She started her career leading large-scale community leadership programs for young people living in underserved communities. She carries this experience with her and continues to create opportunities for young people to get involved in advocacy work. Alana, we're really glad to have you here today. I've seen you now two or three times over this week on various conference calls, and do appreciate your time. And if you wanted to add anything that I wasn't able to add under your opening, please do.
No, that was great. Thank you so much. Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add, just because I wrote my bio a couple of years ago and that's on the website still, is that I now lead our state artificial intelligence program at Public Citizen. Thank you so much for that introduction. It is great to see you again, and good to see a lot of new faces from what I can see, very tiny on this this computer screen. So I am here today. I was invited by Senator Kawasaki to talk about the concerns related to AI deepfakes. So I heard someone ask a question before about legislative solutions to issues. And so I'm going to share a very specific AI related issue and a very specific legislative solution. So I'm going to dive right into it, and I will do my best to keep up with the slides. And I was very impressed by what Addie just did without seeing the slides. So I'm going to do my best to do the same as well. Okay, so deepfakes. I'm going to start by defining deepfakes just so we're all on the same page. And I apologize if this is something that everyone is already very familiar with. But deepfakes are fabricated or fraudulent content. This could be video, audio, images, depicting someone saying or doing something that they never said or did. So I'm actually going to kind of start my presentation by having someone who's operating the computer currently play an audio deepfake, if you will. This is about a year old, I should just say, before it starts. So this technology has actually advanced significantly since this was made, but it gives you a sense of what a deepfake is, and you'll know it immediately. So if you can hit play. I've made a huge mistake. Are you familiar with the 2011 film we bought a suit? The Matt Damon picture. ScarJo was in it as well, although her performance isn't anything to shake a stick at, if I'm being honest. It was directed by Cameron Crowe, the fellow who made Jerry Maguire. Show me the money. Anyway, so I was watching We Bought a Zoo a few days ago because it came up on my Disney Plus after I finished an episode of that Baby Yoda show. All right, thank you. Thank you for that. So that is a silly example for sure, but the application can be incredibly serious. So what this looks like in an elections context can look like a number of different things, but I think the best way to kind of illustrate some of the risk here is by talking about some of the examples that we've already seen. So a couple of months ago in Slovakia, there was a major election, And within 48 hours of that election, a deepfake was circulated of one of the two major party leaders saying that they wanted to rig the election. Now, this person never said that. This was a deepfake. It was an audio deepfake. But they did not have a chance, because it was so close to the election, to dispel this misinformation. And it did, from their perspective, it ended up influencing the outcome of the election. Now, it's impossible, I think, to tell exactly how much it changed the outcome of the election. But that is what is being widely said, is that this influenced the outcome of the Slovakian election. And we're not just seeing it in Slovakia. There was, and I should say, I forgot to say skip slide twice, so you probably need to skip forward to the one that has the Argentina title on it. Apologies. I'm going to do better. We saw a ton of deepfakes in the most recent Argentinian election. They were actually utilized by both candidates. They utilized deepfakes to both make themselves look better. So they put out deepfakes of themselves to make themselves doing and saying things that they never did that made them look actively better. And then they also put out deepfakes of their opponents, doing and saying things that they never did or said that put them in a bad light. And this was the case in Turkey as well. And I think probably folks are aware, but we're already starting to see this in the United States. There was this big headline that broke earlier this week there were robocalls circulating in New Hampshire ahead of the New Hampshire primary, of Joe Biden telling people not to vote. Of course, Joe Biden was not, in fact, calling New Hampshire residents, telling them not to vote in the primary. But once again, this was an audio deepfake. And this is, you know, one of the first major examples that we're seeing in the United States. We certainly have seen some others, but this one was very newsworthy and got a lot of attention earlier this week. So, all of this being said, what experts are saying is that 2024 is going to be the first, quote unquote, true AI election in the United States. So there really is, I think, an urgency to regulating on this issue sooner rather than later. And I think actually there are two other reasons why it's particularly urgent and important that we regulate on this issue now. One is that deepfake technology is becoming rapidly more accessible. In fact, any one of us could create a deepfake. It would take us a couple minutes. It might cost us a couple of bucks to use the technology, but we could create one. And in addition to that technology becoming rapidly more accessible, it is also improving rapidly in quality. So in August of this past year, the NIH put out a study that found that 27 to 50% of people cannot identify a video deepfake. So they could not identify it as being a deepfake. They were tricked by it. So if already just about a half a year ago, a quarter to half of the population was not able to recognize a video deepfake, and the quality of these deepfakes is rapidly improving, that is really concerning. And it is something where technologists have actually said that within a short period of time, even they themselves have concerns that they will not be able to identify what is real and what is a fraudulent deepfake. So this element of deepfakes, which is that they are rapidly more accessible and they are rapidly improving in quality, makes them even more dangerous, and it makes it even more important that we regulate on this as soon as possible. And I think it's not that hard for us to envision a scenario where a deepfake circulated in our own elections, in the US election, close to actual election day, could swing the outcome of our election. And that really is the nightmare scenario here, right? Like, someone is able to defraud the voters into voting in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. And that is antithetical to our democracy, and absolutely something that we want to prevent. And I think, finally, before I kind of get into the solution here, because I know I'm harping on the problem a lot, but I just want to make sure that everyone has a full understanding of this issue. It's not just the immediate concern of an election being swung by a deepfake. There are also kind of these larger societal concerns that we have to think about when thinking about deepfakes as well. And one of the biggest ones is that deepfakes contribute to the erosion of social trust. If there are deepfakes flying around everywhere, right? If we're seeing deepfakes all the time, it will be hard for anyone to know what kinds of information they can actually trust. And on top of that, there absolutely will be people who take advantage of the fact that people do not trust content. So for example, let's say there was actually a bad actor politician and they were caught on camera doing something bad, and a video that made that clear was circulated. Well, they could just turn around and say, no, that's a deep fake. That's not real, right? So it creates this whole ecosystem of information where everything is questionable and no one knows what to trust. And that's just, you know, we're already to some degree in that place, I think, as a society, and we definitely do not want to move more in that direction. We don't want something in our media ecosystem that further erodes trust in information or our democracy. Okay, so I'm done talking about the issue. Now I get to do the fun part of my presentation, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the legislative solutions. So if you can go to the next slide, we should be on a slide that reads at the top, legislation addressing this issue, I guess, obviously. Okay, so I want to start just by noting that the good news here is that there are a number of states who are actively working on this, including in Alaska. There are 5 states that have actually passed legislation to address this issue. These states include Washington State, Michigan, California, Minnesota, and Texas. There are also 26 states that have introduced legislation. This includes Senator Hughes in Alaska. Hello. And then there are at least 10 other states, and I should say I actually know of 11 other states that are actively working on drafting similar legislation at this very moment. Next slide. Public Citizen has put out a tracker that takes stock of all of this legislation, everything that has been passed or introduced. These bills are all linked in this tracker. You can absolutely go and check it out. The link's at the bottom of this page, but I can also send it to the Senator Kawasaki, and maybe you can send it around in case folks are interested. All of these bills look a little bit different, but they're all getting at the same kind of core issue here in regulating deepfakes, political deepfakes specifically. And I think one thing I want to highlight about this tracker and like what we're seeing in the whole across the country is that really there's no kind of pattern to who is putting this legislation forth. As I mentioned before, there are already 31 states in this tracker, 26 states that have introduced, 5 states that have passed. They are red states, blue states, purple states. They're in every part of the geography of the United States. And so, you know, I think it's heartening to see folks proactively addressing an issue and for it to be a very common cause amongst all of these different groups of people across our vast and kind of different country. So next slide. So what are the key elements of legislation that would adequately address fraudulent deepfakes, specifically, again, fraudulent political deepfakes? So Public Citizen has a model bill. We like our model bill, but we're not wedded to it. But we do think there are some important elements to it that I want to highlight just so folks can know what we think are some really important elements to this type of legislation and why those elements are important. So the first element is it prohibits the distribution of unlabeled deepfakes within 90 days of an election. And yes, I said unlabeled deepfakes. This is a disclosure bill. Just out of an abundance of caution, we want to avoid any kind of First Amendment challenges, and that therefore this is a disclosure bill, our model bill. And it is also within the 90-day window of an election. I will say I've looked at the different bills that folks have put forth all across the country, and they really vary on that window. Some folks have a 90-day window, some folks have a 60, 30, and then some just don't have any window at all. But we do think specifically the element of disclosure rather than an all-out ban would be important to avoid any kind of First Amendment concerns. The next element is that our model bill sets up a standard for what a deepfake is. It must be deceptive and fraudulent. In other words, we make it clear that a deepfake is synthetic media that shows a person saying or doing something that they never actually said or did. It is fraudulent. It covers all people. It's not just about candidates, parties, or PACs. It would cover, for example, an individual, and this is, I should say, one of the biggest risks we think may come from, for example, social media influencers. It's not only, you know, broadcast media and political ads that would be a concern in this case. We can imagine a world in which someone who has millions of followers puts out knowingly a fraudulent deepfake and could influence lots of people's thoughts by defrauding them. This model legislation establishes the requirement for disclosure. So it creates really clear guidelines around how you would want to write a disclosure in terms of prominence and clarity, both in a written, so like video or image context, or a spoken context, an audio deepfake, and it establishes a right for affected parties to seek injunctive relief. This is really important because in a case like Slovakia's, or a case where a deepfake is circulated really close to an election, we want to be able to take it down very quickly. Obviously, in any case, you want to be able to take a deepfake down really quickly, but certainly in a really time-sensitive case, you want to have the option to seek injunctive relief. And then finally, it establishes enforcement and penalties. And I should say, next slide. Okay, protections. So there are a couple of exemptions that are included in this bill. One is for broadcasters or platforms that do their due diligence and, you know, do their very best to establish that something is not a deep fake before airing it. Also, there's an exemption for broadcasters or platforms that, you know, are you talking about a deep fake as part of news coverage. So we probably, you know, this would apply to something like what happened on Monday of this week in the news that aired on Tuesday, right? Like, they need to be able to talk about deep fakes and just be able to say clearly this is a deep fake and we're reporting on it. There's an exception for satire, and then there is a severability clause at the end of our model bill. So those are kind of the key elements. I guess next slide, just a thank you slide. Those are the key elements of our model legislation. And this is also, we are working with a number of legislators who are interested in this, interested in regulating on this issue and supporting them in, you know, a number of different ways. And so, you know, I think the whole thing here, the core of the point is this is a real dangerous issue. I think we've established that, but there is a real solution to addressing it. And we very much hope that as many states as possible, including Alaska, will put these important protections in place ahead of our next big election. And it is, again, heartening to see that, as I mentioned before, if you add up all the numbers, already 41 states are in the process of making this a reality. So a little bit of optimism there at the end. And that's all I have. I'm happy to take some questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Alana Beller. We do have several questions here. First from Senator Klayman.
Thanks, Alana. And Ali can also answer what in this legislation process. Sounds like, I mean, so much of this is really interstate, not just single states. Why isn't the big push on your behalf to get federal legislation passed that then states could potentially seek to enforce that or bring a cause of action? But why isn't this being done more on a federal level than a state level? Because, boy, it sure sounds like interstate commerce to me.
Yes, we would love for this legislation to pass on a federal level. We did support a bipartisan group of senators in drafting a federal bill. And apologies, I have an 8-month-old in daycare, so I'm just going to have to blow my nose constantly, probably for the rest of my life. But But it is, so Senator Klobuchar and Senator Hawley put forth a bill seeking to address this issue. It does not seem likely, frankly, that it will pass ahead of the 2024 election. And on top of that, apologies, this legislation would only regulate, this would only apply to federal election candidates versus on a state level, it would apply to all folks up and down the ballot. And then on top of that, Public Citizen actually put forth a petition to the FEC for rulemaking on this issue. But unfortunately, the FEC has been slow walking that. They said they would be looking to make a decision this summer, but in that case, it is extremely unlikely that a rule would be in place ahead of the 2024 election. So we absolutely are pursuing this on a federal level, but if I'm being really honest, we don't feel particularly optimistic that anything will be in place in time. And we are seeing states take action on this. And like I said, states fill an important role here in that regardless of whether federal legislation was passed, the only way that folks on a state legislative and a local legislative level would be protected is if the states pass legislation.
And a follow-up question on the same, if the state doesn't pass legislation, is your perspective that individual candidates would have a right of action to bring a cause of action in civil court, basically saying somebody put a fraudulent ad up and tell them to stop? Or do we need legislation to do that?
Correct. You need legislation to do that. There's currently no legislation on the books saying that putting forth a fraudulent deepfake is illegal.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a question for Addie. I'm wondering if there's any, what the technology is like for determining maybe camera technology or scanners, whether that's able to validate whether or not the videos are real?
Great question. So this is a technology that's very much in development, and I'm not sure if I put something in the chat if y'all will get it. But Google DeepMind and Google Cloud recently announced our version of digital watermarking that we are talking to a lot of other companies about adopting. It's called SynthID, so synthetic identification. I'll put our announcement out here, but essentially what our proposition is and what we're trying to do is provide a tool which allows for watermarking and for verification, because it's really important to understand that the technology is actually two different technologies. You need something that puts the stamp there, and you also need something that validates the stamp there. And two different people need to hold that stamp. We have a whole team of folks who work on provenance of images and videos, and that is what this is. It's determining the provenance of a video or an image. It needs to be standardized, quite frankly, and this is why it's really important that we continue these conversations. Like I was saying earlier in my earlier response to the question, it's an industry approach. And honestly, it's transnational. It's global. Governments also need to say this is the one technology we're all going to use to make sure that we can all agree that this is an authentic video. This is an authentic image. We're not alone. There are a lot of other technology vendors out there, developers out there trying to introduce solutions to this problem that we all agree absolutely needs to be addressed. And honestly, I remain hopeful that we will be able to agree on a global standard. And I think the resources that we're putting behind solving the problem are resources well spent. And you know, I like to think about it a little bit like the music industry, where, you know, I never thought we'd get past the Napster days, and somehow here I am. So I do feel like there's always going to be a solution, but it will take partnerships and interoperability and all of those agreements to be able to make sure it's a valid solution.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
maybe for you, Addie or Ilana, is the technology advanced enough, or has there been any thought given to legislation that says before a political ad or something dealing with politics, maybe 90 days before an election can be shown on Facebook, Twitter, wherever, it's got to be run through this synthetic analyzer.
Yeah. And certainly I'm sure Alana has thoughts on this. I think until you reach an agreement about which technology we're all going to use or which technology is a valid technology, it's hard to create a mandate. But I think there's still a market incentive to start using these technologies to see which one is actually going to take hold. And that's why we're putting ours out in the market. We hope it's the one that solves some of this problem. I don't know that it's quite ready for prime time. And I should also note, even the best model, and we note this in our blog posts, the best technology is always going to be subverted by very sophisticated actors. We're trying to catch as much as we can, you know, Joe Blow putting together a deep fake at home using ChatGPT. But, you know, you will continue to have state actors. So educating the public about not believing everything they see, making sure that, you know, media organizations have the tools they need to also educate the public. If you're never going to get me, that's always going to exist, in my opinion. And Alana, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are very much in support of watermarking. But as Addy said, right now, it is not possible I actually don't know how you say it. Provide provenance. Is that correct, Daddy? Or like prove provenance? Okay, great. I see folks from Google shaking their head. That's a good sign. But so I think one thing just to clarify on this legislation is that it is not about the creator. It is about the circulator. So this legislation holds liable the person who is circulating the deepfake, not the creator of the deepfake. So that could, of course, be the same person. It could be the person who creates the deepfake, who then is putting it out into the world and making sure everyone sees it. But it is much easier to determine who was the person who put the deepfake out there for everyone to view than it is to determine the creator at this point in time. And so again, this legislation actually holds liable the person who is circulating the deepfake.
Thank you very much. I have a question maybe for whoever wants to answer, but you know, we talked about ChatGPT back in December last year, and we thought about introducing legislation, and then we heard from a lot of folks about, you know, that just we don't want to also sort of chill the discussion and sort of the strength of what artificial intelligence does that's not the bad stuff. So how do we sort of balance the good stuff that AI can do with, you know, like within some of our state agencies versus some of the things that are bad that could be, you know, especially when we obviously politicians, we're talking about campaigns a lot. So maybe somebody from Google would start.
Yeah, sure. So, we can take that answer a bunch of different ways. And, you know, as I've said, I work on the enterprise side, so I won't speak to the consumer side, but I can tell you that, you know, in the context of security, and let's just take, you know, AI generated security hacks, AI generated security threats. The one way to it that we're going to mitigate to fight back against those threats is also using AI. You actually have to fight AI using AI. One of my favorite solutions that we've put on the market is our SecPalm. So it's our security large language model. And what we've done with this package of solutions is, you know, search is one of the most hacked. One of the websites that people have tried to hack the most for the last 20 years. You know, if you could hack google.com, that's like one of the holy grails. And so over time, we've built a massive library of all the hacks that we've ever seen, all of the threats we've ever seen to google.com. And using this library, we've actually trained a model to identify threats coming into a system. And so our SecPalm solution is, it's an out-of-box solution. You can put it right on top of your you know, your enterprise platform, and it'll monitor threats based on what we've trained it on for the past 20 years. And that's just a good example of, you know, using AI to fight AI. And I say this because I hear you. There are absolutely risks, and we need to make sure that we're educating users of these tools, and agencies, users, citizen users of these tools, in what the challenges are. Security, privacy, there's absolutely real challenges. You know, we may not have done a good job of educating people when we first started using social media, but we have an opportunity today to show them, you know, to demonstrate, make sure in their vocabulary, hallucinations, privacy protecting, that these are all part of sort of known issues that they need to understand when they operate. But using it to their advantage, using it in security context, using it to scan for privacy. You know, at Google, we use, when we're working with an enterprise customer, when they send us data to train a model, our contracts require that they strip it of all PII, but we don't trust the customer just to do that. We actually use AI to scan the data to make sure that the PII is in fact been removed before we will accept the data. And that's just an example of, you know, how these tools can be used to actually give extra protections. I love that your thought was not let's just ban it, because it's really critical that our citizens learn how to use it, because the world is learning how to use it, and we need to be right there in order to not only be competitive but also to protect ourselves and see, you know, how it can deliver benefits to our daily lives.
Great. Thanks, Addie. We have another question from Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the panel, I'm wondering, you mentioned some First Amendment concerns, and the remedy to those concerns was labeling. When communications are required to be labeled, have you heard any further First Amendment concerns about that step? If communications, let's say a political advertisement, is labeled, are there additional First Amendment concerns that you've heard that would trouble a law from standing a court challenge?
So we have found, we in the five states that have passed this, we have found that at least in the states that we supported in, there were no further actually concerns from really anyone that were getting in the way of moving this legislation forward. So if the question is around, like, are there further First Amendment concerns in this legislation, I would actually say the one other piece of our set of recommendations that is really important for addressing First Amendment concerns are those exemptions at the end. So for example, having an exemption for satire is important for First Amendment reasons. But in terms of, like, further First Amendment concerns in the case where there is a labeling requirement, I'm not aware of anything, and we haven't run into that at all.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, Elena. So, you know, you showed us the first model, and I heard the one that was broadcast in New Hampshire just prior to the primary, and it did sound like President Biden, but it actually didn't say, "Hey, this is President Biden. I don't want you to vote." So, what in that case, I guess, you know, would prevent a person under the current laws that you're looking at from doing that? I mean, that's obviously sort of, I know what they're trying to do, but it doesn't say, "Hey, I'm Joe Biden." It just sounds a lot like him. It's his likeness, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a couple of things. One, I mean, that would most likely just have to play out in court. I'm relatively sure in that situation where it is someone who is, like, they're clearly utilizing Joe Biden's voice and, like, certain mannerisms that he has. Like, they used the word malarkey right at the beginning, right? They were, like, very clearly trying to be Joe Biden in addition to actually using a deepfake machine to use his voice. I I honestly don't know, like, what, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly how that court case would play out. And maybe there is some kind of plausible deniability thing that could happen in a specific audio related deep fake. So I don't know if I'm like, honestly, I think I would need a lawyer to be able to answer that particular question. But I would imagine that would just, they would have to prove in court that they were trying to impersonate Joe Biden and utilize his voice. I will say, regardless, the injunctive relief would kick in. So you'd be immediately able to take it down until, you know, and then it would be a question of like how the penalties play out longer term.
Thanks. Thank you. I had another question because, Addie, you mentioned personal private information. We have in our current budget, I don't know if folks have seen it, but there's several tens and tens of thousands of dollars for extra time allotted to DPS and several other places for information from the press, public information that's supposed to be accessed from the press, because sometimes the press or the public will ask for information, and then a lot of that has to go through redaction through our Department of Law. So we've seen that, and I think maybe you could tell us just a little bit more about how that operates as far as PPI goes.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it sounds like your question is about technical tools that might be available to help you redact FOIA-type requests at the state level to expedite returning results to constituents. I think that's a great use case, and I would love to follow up with you if that's okay, to see what the solution is and maybe give you a little context around how it works. I think that I hadn't considered, that's a really fun use case and actually a really good example of narrowing in on what's the thing you need to solve for and can you apply AI to it. Tim and I will definitely get that over to you after this.
Great. Thank you, Addie. Are there further questions of the panel? Okay, we do have a question from Senator Kelly Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki. Thank you, ladies. This presentation was very interesting. We've talked a lot about political ads. Have you heard concerns from law enforcement agencies about the fabrication of evidence?
That is not a concern we've heard. That is just something that hasn't been brought up. It's interesting, but we have not heard that.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Thanks. I wanted to thank all the panelists that called in today. You know, we're just, like a lot of states, thinking about artificial intelligence. We hear about, of course, the New Hampshire primary on Monday and the Joe Biden deepfake. Then we saw on CNN about Taylor Swift. And we see all of these different things coming out at us very, very quickly. I think a lot of folks, I mean, we even have a person in the legislature that used artificial intelligence to help create a bill and legislation. And so we've got questions about that. So I think there's a lot of things that we've got. We also have a piece of legislation from Senator Shelley Hughes, who's introduced a bill specifically about political deepfakes, and we will be hearing that bill at a later time. But before we go, I just, again, wanted to thank Addie Cook from Google, as well as Tim Johnson from Google, and Alana Beller from Public Citizen for being here today. I'm sure we will interact a little bit more in the future as we delve through this AI policy during the legislative session. Are there any other questions before we conclude the meeting today? Okay. We are going to conclude the meeting. And again, once again, thanks Addie Cook and Alana Beller for the presentations. The next meeting that we've scheduled is for next Tuesday, January 28th, where we will hear the executive order number 128. And that is a executive order to separate the membership of the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. On Thursday, February 1st, we will have a first hearing for Senate Bill 159, the Alaska Veterans Poppy Day Bill, by Senator Dunbar and Representative Stapp. We will also hear Senate Bill 177, which relates specifically to the topics today: artificial intelligence, deepfakes, cybersecurity, data transfers, sponsored by Shelley Hughes. If there's no other questions or comments at this time, we'll go ahead and adjourn. Once again, thank you very much for participating today.